Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, July 7th, 2005. I'm your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. With me tonight are Evan Bernstein.
Hi, everyone.
Perry DeAngelis.
Present.
And Robert Novella.
Here.
So dominating the news today, not a skeptical topic, but worthy of mention, was the massive terrorist attack on the London subway system. The toll stands now at over 40 killed and over 700 injured. Just a massive attack. So, of course, our thoughts are with the families and victims of that horrible attack.
Amen.
I thought we would start today with just talking about Science Magazine. They have their 125th anniversary, and to commemorate that, they have compiled 125 science questions that we still do not know, and it's an interesting read.
I actually filled in the answers to those questions and sent them in to Science. They'll be
Did
in
you?
The next issue.
They're going to publish them next time?
Publish in the next issue. Clear
Perry,
that
number,
up.
Perry, number seven was wrong, by the way.
That's your opinion, sir. Your opinion.
So these are mostly big, huge science questions that still do not have an answer. For example, what controls organ regeneration? How do skin cells differentiate into nerve cells when an embryo is developing?
Skin cells? I mean, they become skin cells first, then they become nerve cells? Don't they just go from, like, a stem cell to a nerve cell?
Let's ask a neurologist. Steve, how do skin cells,
you know what I mean,
turn into nerve
Yeah, well, they can... I don't think they're talking about a fully differentiated skin cell, but more of a filler cell, the kind that would then... like form scar tissue or cause regeneration in some animals.
Well, this sounds like it's part of the stem cell debate.
Yeah, it's definitely along that line. They are talking about, I guess, adult-derived stem cells.
That's the B-gene rather of stem cells.
Right. Seems rather specific to me and not more of a general statement.
How are memories stored and retrieved? Well, we have somewhat of an answer.
Yeah, we have a decent idea about that. That's weird.
One is, are we alone in the universe? Still an unanswered question.
I just saw War of the Worlds. I don't know.
well Perry, what planet did you come from?
That's a secret. That was question 126. I didn't quite make it on the list.
What are the limits of conventional computing?
Oh, come on. I've read articles about that.
So you're not impressed with their
Not with a
questions.
Couple of them. I mean, there are physical limits, Physics places limits on what computers can do. If your smallest element was an electron traveling at the speed of light, then this is how fast your computer could possibly be, including heat dissipation and all sorts of, whatever. Maybe.
Good spot for a trivia question. What is Data's, Star Trek Next Gen's, ultimate storage capacity?
Oh God, it was like 600.
Come on, Bob.
600 petaflops?
That's what he said.
Oh, my God.
What did he say, Perry?
800 quadrillion bits.
800 quadrillion bits.
That's what he
lot.
Said. He announced that bits. One of the shows.
A lot of bits. How many bytes is that?
Capacity. I have an old
I remember it.
800 quadrillion bits.
I remember that, and I remember calculating what that was and not being very impressed about
really?
It.
Really?
Yeah.
Considering
it was
1989.
Yeah, think about how long ago that show was written.
I mean, really, it was pre-internet, that show. And computers were far less powerful than they
if it was
are
still, today,
regardless,
they
were capable.
It would have been considerably higher.
Still, you would think, they would take today's ultimate and just add, make it four orders of magnitude.
Right, a Googleplex to the Googleplex power or something like that.
That's true. In fact, I'm often startled at the density of television writers. I'm really shocked. Most of them impress me as...
Well, Star Trek was notorious for techno-babble.
Oh.
Scientific, technological-sounding, sound bites, but ultimately vacuous.
Right.
Here's a good one. Can the laws of physics be unified? That is definitely and you know, if so, how? That's huge unanswered question.
It goes from questions like that to questions like this. What is the structure of water? I mean, that sounds very basic. That sounds like something that scientists should be able to all agree on at this point of our knowledge of science, but
they must be talking about homeopathy.
Right, that's exactly right. It says here, researchers continue to tussle over how many bonds each H2O molecule makes with its nearest neighbors.
Ah.
That's fascinating.
Not the structure of a single water molecule, but the greater structure, the superstructure of water, how they interact with each other.
How many bonds?
How many bonds?
Are they individual?
It's either one or two. I don't know.
Well, while we're perusing this science trivia, that's a good segue into the next segment of our program, which is science or fiction.
Ooh.
Fiction.
Yes.
It's time to play science or fiction.
So there are, as we do each week, I will introduce three science news items. Two are real, one is fake, and my skeptical colleagues will have to sniff out the fake science story. And typically I will make the fake one as plausible as possible, but you have to know what the false element is to really figure it out.
I have a question before we continue.
Sure.
Did your false statement from last week turn out to be true this week?
Not as far as I know.
Well, then I guess the streak is officially over then?
The streak is over unless something crops up soon. But the last week the false one was that chimpanzees have been observed communicating in written symbols, and written was the new element. So are you ready for the three items?
Yeah.
Sure. Okay. Again, I'll list all three, and then I'll give you a chance to comment. Item number one. Scientists have created a new form of matter called a superfluid gas. Item number two, scientists discovered the oldest living organism, a conifer, that's an evergreen tree, over 10,000 years old. And item number three, scientists have discovered a fossil of a mammal with a dinosaur in its stomach. So those are the three items.
Well, this is kind of weird because I actually think I've read about all three of those. But
the third one sounds familiar to me.
One must be not quite true. So
after the first two, I'm thinking I got this one. Then the
it's
third one
sounded
good.
They all sound plausible. Huh?
Did you read about one of them in a comic book? No. all right, so we got superfluid gas. What is that now?
A new form of matter called a superfluid gas.
Superfluid gas. Then we got number three was the dinosaur in the stomach, and number two was the conifer, 10,000 years old.
10,000 year old, yeah.
At least the superfluid gas is not trading at $61 a barrel. I can guarantee you that.
Probably much more.
Don't get me started.
Yeah, but we digress. I'm going to take a stab first. I'm going to say number three is the false one. And I don't think, and here's my reason. I think there's, Steve, I think what you're doing is using the words mammal and dinosaur, and there's some kind of play in there. It's not quite exactly the way you phrased it. It's something similar, but not actually a dinosaur in the stomach of a mammal. So I kind of think that's why number three, I think, is false.
But I will try not to be tricky or to play on words. And the scientific facts are either true or not true. So what we're talking about is the fossil evidence of that a mammal had eaten a dinosaur.
I'll stay with number three.
Okay. Bob, Perry, what's your...
Bob is next.
Bob, is your gut talking to you?
Perry's next. Yeah, it's my gut's saying I have no idea because they all ring a bell with me. So... superfluid gas. I've read about the dinosaur and the mammal.
Bob, you got to know about superfluid gas. You're Mr. Physics.
Pardon me. Well, I'm actually listing here the states of matter that I am familiar with, and come up with six. You got a gas. You have liquid. You have solid.
Everyone I know those three.
Right? You guys know those. Then there's a plasma. which is basically molecules blood. Atoms that have had their electrons ripped from the nucleus, and that's like the atmosphere of the sun is a plasma, and it is the most common phase of matter in the universe is plasma. Then you got a Bose-Einstein condensate and a fermionic condensate. And I did read about another state that they were talking about, and I kind of remember it being something like a superfluid gas.
Boson condensate?
Bose
that's
Einstein.
The water that collects on cows in the morning?
Exactly, exactly. Wow.
That's bovine condensation.
I'm surprised you know that one. That was good. It's really a very interesting state of matter, but superfluid gas, conifer. The dino I'm most confident about, the conifer, God, I read something about something tree-related that was extremely old. Wow, Perry, you go. I'm going to have to mull this over a few more seconds.
That's a guess. Could a plant survive 10,000 years? I suppose it was frozen solid, evergreen tree, being a cold climate. We had a new cold climate, an old cold climate. That seems possible. I have no idea about the superfluid gas, though. Though that's an interesting term for Steve to come up with out of the blue. Maybe somebody was working on it or something. All right, I'm guessing. I'm going to go with number one. I think number one is false.
Okay, Bob. Gotta make a decision.
Yeah.
Put your nickel down.
I'm gonna go with the superfluid gas. I think the name is subtly incorrect. Why would they have gas as a different state of matter when it can't really be a gas? The conifer, man, I remember. Maybe it wasn't quite 10,000 years. Maybe Steve is exaggerating the age a little, but I remember it was quite old. Maybe it's only 5,000. But I'm gonna go with the superfluid gas.
All right, so we got two ones.
And a three.
From that laugh, I guess.
So we'll take them in order. We'll start with number one.
All right.
MIT physicists create a new form of matter is the headline. What they did was it's a super cool gas. And the key is to get the gas to achieve a super fluid state. What they call high temperature superfluidity. Now, to them,
high temperature.
High temperature. that was really the breakthrough. But the high temperature is 50 billionths of a degree Kelvin. They call that high temperature, 50 nanokelvins. But that's higher than anyone has been able to do it before. And the importance is, to superfluidity is sort of similar to superconductivity. It would be a very, very useful property for materials to have.
Right. A superfluid can do very unusual things, like travel uphill. Things like that. Very bizarre behavior for superfluid.
So they are calling it a superfluid gas. It is a gas. It is a fermion gas, Bob. You actually were very, very close to that.
I said number one wasn't true, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right.
Why did I say that?
I don't know.
I mean, I specifically said that's not something you'd make up.
I guess maybe you gave me more credit in
the I just got it wrong in my own head. I was stupid.
Okay.
I deserve to get it wrong.
No argument here.
All right.
Let's move on.
Number two. The Earth's oldest living inhabitant, called Methuselah, a biblical reference, is a bristlecone pine. The oldest single individual that has been recorded is 4,767 years. Very close to your guess of 5,000, Bob.
Ah, that's why you laughed. I knew it.
10,000. I doubled it. 10,000. No, so that's the oldest living thing. 10,000 is too long. So that's why that one is wrong.
Okay.
But there are the bristlecone pine, 4,767 years is the oldest specific individual. There's many examples of them in California and in Japan in, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years old. And the third one this is just you either have to hear it or not. This was a news item. Dinosaur was dinner at least once. Fossil shows mammal refused to be a victim and ate a cetacosaur. I think that's how you pronounce it. So this is basically like a dog-sized mammal that was around at the time of the dinosaurs, eating basically like the biggest mammal at the time, or one of them, eating one of the smallest dinosaurs of the time.
What impact would this have on Kansas at all, Steve?
It was the I don't believe the fossil was discovered in Kansas. It was discovered in China. Other than that, I don't nothing.
You don't think it'll have any impact on the intelligent design debate?
What, evidence affecting intelligent design theory?
Yeah.
I doubt it. They're calling this the T-Rex of mammals, Rapenomammus robustus. This is the first fossil evidence that of any animal, of any mammal having eaten a dinosaur. It's interesting. It's a curiosity because the textbook, you know, canonical story is of
small rodents running around.
Small rodents living in the shadow of the giant dinosaurs and dinosaurs eating mammals.
Way to go, mammals.
It's all in the Bible.
So there you have it. So the first and the third one were correct, and the second one was incorrect because I doubled the age of the oldest living tree from 5,000 approximately to 10,000.
I want to disqualify myself this week based on stupidity.
No. We were perfect this week, so we can move on.
Interesting. These are obviously designed to be very difficult, and it's tests not only your knowledge of scientific trivia, but also just are you keeping up with the latest stories in the news?
And it's also an exercise to show people that no matter what people say, it may sound scientific, but it could be far from true.
And some things that sound fantastical can be true. You know, like a 5,000-year-old tree, that's pretty out there.
Like birds that stay aloft for 10 years.
For 10 years at a time, right. Like the sooty tern from last week's example. So
yeah.
I will continue to...
I still want to see the 10-year video of that thing, but that's another story.
Told you.
I'll continue to scour the science news for the most extraordinary stories, and this is sort of a fun way to hear about it. Something else, speaking of funny items in the news, I'm sure all of you have heard or seen our friend Tom Cruise in the news in the last couple of weeks.
Your friend Tom Cruise, yes.
As you may or may not know, Tom Cruise, who you know is a very, very good actor, who is box office smash. His movie out right now is War of the Worlds.
And as my wife says, not bad to look at either.
Not bad to look at. Yeah, I think my wife concurs on that as well. So, again, a brilliant actor, but who also happens to be a Scientologist. Scientology is a 50-year-old religion. Some people who are not charitable would call it a cult.
An actor's mind is a terrible thing to waste.
Right. Yeah, Scientology has actually aggressively, recruited or proselytized to Hollywood stars because it wants them as its spokespeople. And, they've been successful. Not only Tom Cruise, but...
Christy Alley?
Oh, John Travolta. John Travolta,
Christy Alley. And others.
A few other assorted kooks.
But the Tom Cruise episode brought out one interesting aspect of Scientology that I don't know how many people are aware of, and that Scientologists are very anti-psychiatry. They maintain that psychiatry, as Tom Cruise said directly, Scientology is that psychiatry is a pseudoscience, and they deny essentially the entire modern discipline, modern science of mental health.
Tom Cruise said there is no such thing as a chemical imbalance.
Right. There is no such thing as a chemical imbalance.
The reason that he focuses on that, I believe, is because the main thrust of all of Scientology plays into that whole field. So, of course, they feel that they have to support their, mind view, if you will,
right.
How the human mind works. And that's why he has such a problem with it, because of what they believe.
Yeah, basically they're the creationists of mental illness. I mean, they oppose a specific scientific discipline because their religious faith disagrees with it, so that they basically mount a very aggressive, sophisticated campaign against psychiatry, the same way that creationists mount a campaign against evolution. But on the surface, the Scientologists' views of mental illness are the idea that all of our psychological problems, all of the baggage that we carry with us, is due to what they call engrams. Engrams are basically memories, subconscious memories of past trauma, even going back to the womb. And that the only way to get rid of your mental illnesses or your psychological problems and is to clear yourself of these bad memories, these engrams. And the goal of Scientologists is to become what they call a clear, basically cleared of engrams. Of course, you know, as wacky as that may seem, and as contradictory to, you know, to modern neurology, that's actually not the real beliefs that they have. That's only the surface belief. That's the Dianetics, you know, level ideas that they have. In reality, what they believe is that people are being parasitically infested by the spirits of dead space aliens that were exiled to Earth by an extraterrestrial dictator. What's his name called? Xenu?
Xenu, I think.
Yeah, Xenu.
So, Steve,
Xenu?
Is it like a possession then? But they don't really see it like, really like a possession. But it sounds like possession to me.
Yeah, well, like, it's more of a it's like a psychic parasite, you know, I think, is the way they... So, which, of course, you know, makes it interesting that, you know, Tom Cruise, who thinks that alien parasites are sucking off our mental health, calls psychiatry a pseudoscience. That is the pot calling the kettle black, if ever there were one. But I mean, it's just ridiculous. But interestingly, the Scientologists do find allies among, you know, others who also question the basic tenets of psychiatry, that question the concepts of you know, mental illnesses being due to chemical imbalances in the brain. There is a psychiatrist who's now, you know, pushing 90, the guy's ancient, called Thomas Szasz, who, you know, 40, 50 years ago, we had some legitimate, you know, criticisms of the way psychiatry was being practiced. But basically, all of his legitimate criticisms have been dealt with over the years, and, you know, psychiatry is definitely a much more, you know, humane,
it's matured
ethical
like
practice.
All, yeah, it's matured like all medical science has in the last 50 years.
But, you know, they're definitely, you know, you did not want to be mentally ill 50 years ago and be institutionalized. I mean, you really had no rights. But those issues really have been dealt with, and led one, you know, sort of critic of Thomas Szasz to comment that, you know, he should just declare victory and move on. I mean, the battle that he was fighting is over. But, you know, Thomas Szasz and his disciples and have taken, you know, sort of criticism of some of these sort of questionable ethics of old school, you know, psychiatry, to the point of saying that there's no such thing as mental illness. And, you know, I have engaged in, you know, debates and discussions with, you know, dozens of people who hold that belief. I don't know if any of them were Scientologists. They might have been. They don't always, you know, label themselves as such. But some certainly were not. They were psychologists or therapists or just, you know, interested lay people who have bought into this very elaborate belief system that I call psychiatry denial, which is just a denial of mental illness. The silliest thing about it is that it really denies the basic fact that the brain is a biological organ, right? It's just like your liver.
Yeah.
You know? And
it's true.
Just like your liver can fail and not function properly and have, you know, chemical imbalances and hypo or hyperfunctioning of different, you know, aspects of the liver cells, the same is true of your brain. I mean, the only difference is that the brain is a lot more complex, which means that there could be a lot more subtle imbalances.
I can speak from personal experience. When I had some complications from surgery in 2000, I got delirium and I was not in control of myself. I was in the hospital. I thought aliens had kidnapped me and were, whatever, I don't know, trying to do experiments on me, I guess. I pulled my feeding tube out of my nose violently, swearing at people around me. I mean, my brain was compromised.
Your brain was not functioning normally.
by the illness, you know, I woke up to find myself tied to the bed.
Yet there were those who would deny the very obvious and basic conclusion that your brain was not biologically functioning normally because, you know, you had a fever and metabolic parameters were out of whack.
Right.
they would try to interpret that as, you know, in psychological terms. But it's psychological terms. It's meaningless. Your brain cells were not working. That's what it comes down to. But, you know, Tom Cruise says there's no such thing as a chemical imbalance. He was very critical of Brooke Shields, who had suffered from postpartum depression and took some antidepressants, which he says helped her a great deal. He made some comment about, well, all you need is vitamins and exercise, which is, again, just, you know, pulling nonsense.
Yeah, where have we heard that before?
Anyway, so I think a lot of the, you know, some of the press focused a lot on just sort of, you know, the religious aspects of Scientology or on his sort of extreme views, but I didn't really hear anyone make the connection between the really bizarre
right.
beliefs of Scientology and what was motivating
nobody knows
Tom
about
Cruise,
him, that's why, Steve.
Right, to in his, you know, denial of, you know, behavioral neuroscience, basically. But again, I do think that the parallels between the psychiatry denial of Scientologists and evolution denial of creationists are very real and very interesting. They're very telling. And one of the advantages of being what we call ourselves, we're full service skeptics. You know, we really deal with all issues across the spectrum. The real advantage to that is that you see the underlying similarities. You know, they all use the same logical fallacies over and over again, the same sort of errors in thought, the same, you know, strategies of denial. It doesn't really matter what the topic is. You know, of course, if you're going to talk intelligently about a specific topic, you do need to know the factual details. You know, you can't speak in a vacuum. You know, what we call armchair skepticism, just sort of shooting from the hip. You do have to sort of know the nitty-gritty details. But the flaws in logic and the mechanisms of deception that people employ are all the same, whether you're a Scientologist or a creationist or you believe in ghosts or UFOs or Bigfoot. It doesn't matter.
Wait, what's wrong with Bigfoot?
UFO, sure, it's that Bigfoot.
But Bigfoot, it's a great website. It's a very useful website. I enjoy.
Yeah, right.
Well, Bob, why don't we take this time for you to tell us what the skeptical website of the week is?
One of my favorite skeptical websites is Snopes.com. It's not strictly. It is skeptical. It's a little offbeat in that it discusses urban legends. I mean,
how
we're
do you
all
spell
familiar.
That, Bob?
Snopes.com or urban legends?
Snopes. Give us the URL. What is
yeah,
it?
Give us the URL.
www.snopes.com.
Okay.
Time Magazine in 2002 and 2003 listed it as one of the 50 best websites. And it, like I said, it contains urban legends, lots of internet lore, odd news stories, strange facts and misconceptions.
It's a great resource. I go.
It is. It's a great resource. If you read something, if you get an email or someone tells you about some bizarre story, go to the site and do a search and see if it's a bona fide false urban legend or if there might be some truth to it. And he's got dozens of categories from science to religion, Coke lore, as in Coca-Cola, food and Disney, all these amazing stories that people, a lot of people take for granted
right.
and don't really think about it, but actually are urban legends.
Bob, and, you say he has? Is it a one-man band?
There is a guy. He's actually a contributor to my skeptical email group, and it's just he identifies himself as Snopes. But yeah, it's a guy. I'm
you don't know his real name?
I don't. Let's see. Urban Legends by Barbara and David Mickelson. I wonder if that's him.
must be.
Mystery solved. So give us some examples. Give us some examples.
Sure. I went to the science section, of course, and came up with some here. And you guys, let me know what you think.
So are all of these fake, or there are some real ones too?
He has categories: true, false. Then he's got undetermined or ambiguous veracity.
Okay.
And then he has another one here that actually I won't cover, but he has entries of indeterminate origin, and I think that actually covers things that are, it's such a vague story that it probably happened to someone somewhere, but it's just not specific enough to tell you whether yes, this absolutely happened, but it probably did to somebody at some point. But here's a couple. Let's see. Consumers need to be cautious that water boiled in a microwave oven can suddenly explode.
That sounds ridiculous.
water explode? No, it will boil.
Yeah, I mean, unless it's in a tightly closed container.
Yeah, I mean, I doubt that the microwave itself is airtight.
Sounds dubious.
I mean, you certainly don't want to boil water inside a sealed container, because once it starts to boil, it will explode.
Right.
You wouldn't want to do that in a microwave or a campfire.
Never heat a closed system.
He lists that as true, and I don't think it necessarily needs to be a closed box or a closed system in any way. It's just that I'm not sure. The impression I have is that because, I don't know, after you open it, it reaches some critical heat that causes it to just explode out of the container.
All right, wait a minute. So his website, Bob, says true with no explanation?
No, there is an explanation.
Oh.
I have got a link here. I could follow it and see, but let me click it and see what comes up.
Yeah, because to us it sounds ridiculous.
Yeah, here it is. He's got a big page here on this. True but rare. That's a status he's got here. True but rare. And I don't want to waste time reading this, but
it's something I'm going to have to read.
He gives an example of the story behind it. He describes the origins of the story. He then cites some articles in which this is mentioned, for instance, from New Scientist, from the How Things Work website, and so forth. So he does some research, puts it all together in one page, and puts it up there for you.
But what's exploding?
Exploded?
Actually, it involves superheating.
Okay.
Let's see.
So the water's overheated?
But superheating involves pressure.
I'm here now, and it says, it takes near-perfect conditions to bring this about, thus exploding water is not something the average hot beverage drinker, who would otherwise now be eyeing his microwave with trepidation, need fear. Odds are you'll go through life without ever viewing this phenomenon firsthand, and if you're one of the rare few who does get to see it, you will likely not be harmed by the experience.
So it's a very small explosion. It doesn't blow the microwave apart.
Okay. No. So what's happening here is that you've got you've got water that's actually slightly above the boiling point because of a lack of nucleation sites. Those are sites that gas bubbles form
right.
around. When you boil water before you throw pasta in, the bubbles coming up are created at nucleation sites.
Right.
Here's a better example. If you pour a glass of champagne and you look and you see these bubbles appearing at a certain point on the glass and then rising through the liquid and getting bigger and bigger. Those are nucleation sites. Common rain needs these nucleation sites to start forming around. If we had no impurities in our atmosphere, it'd be very difficult for rain to form. So it involves superheating, and I think all of a sudden, since it's hotter than actually 212 Fahrenheit, all of a sudden, maybe it finds some nucleation sites, and bam, it just overboils. So what
causes the lack of nucleation sites?
Certain glasses he's saying here are the glass is very well made or something, and that there's not many nucleation sites.
Yeah,
okay,
that's interesting.
That's enough on this one.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's enough, but it's interesting.
Okay,
these other ones are great.
Here's a good one. The number of people alive today is greater than the number of people who have ever died. Now that's a very common one. I've heard that over and over, and I believed it.
I'm going to say that's false. Yeah, right. There has to have been more than 6 billion people
who have ever lived. Right, and it is false. And here's another great one. The Great Wall of China is the only man-made object visible from the moon.
From the moon?
It's not visible from the moon.
From the moon?
It's visible from orbit.
But the moon is
a little far.
Quarter million miles away.
Yeah, from low Earth orbit, it's visible. Like if you're in the shuttle, you can see it. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, this from the moon is right is ridiculous because the Earth is pretty tiny when you're standing on the moon. But I've also heard another form of this being that it's the only thing you can see from orbit that's man-made, and that's also false.
How far is the moon? How far is the Earth from the moon?
200.
Quarter million miles.
Quarter million.
239,000 miles.
Two light seconds.
I'm sure that fluctuates a little.
Hair and fingernails continue to grow after one's death.
That is false.
That is false. I believe the skin peels away.
The skin retracts, from drying.
All right. Men think about sex every 7 seconds.
True. Oh, sorry.
That's false. That's a very common one.
How long has the show
been?
How many thoughts? That's false, huh?
And yes, mm-hmm. And one of my favorites, thanks to the Coriolis effect, toilets flush clockwise in the northern hemisphere and counterclockwise in the southern.
Yeah, that's cool.
And that is false as well.
We all know that's
false.
Bob
wrote an article about that for our newsletter.
That Coriolis effect is only measurable in very large bodies of water.
And yeah, over long
oceans.
It affects hurricanes and things like that, but not your toilet bowl.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, the toilet bowl is just too small and it goes too fast. Basically, the direction that the water spins around when you flush depends on the direction it was going when it entered and the odd shape of the receptacle and things like that.
Right.
And
here's another water-related one that I heard. Tell me if I know that Evan knows this one because we've spoken about it. But if you put hot water in an ice cube tray in the freezer, it will freeze quicker than if you put cold water in the ice cube trays to freeze into ice.
I've heard that question as well.
Boiling water, if it's hot to start with or cold to start with? Okay, I don't know. Let's see. The water is it's moving faster, right? The molecules, if it's hotter.
Right.
But it's still, if it's hotter, it would take longer to equalize with the freezer.
That doesn't seem right.
It doesn't seem right, and I didn't believe it when I first said that. Can't be right because hot water has farther to cool down. It's just thermodynamics. There's nothing, special about it.
Seems very commonsensical.
But it turns out that it's true.
Uh-huh. What's the physics behind it? Here's
why. And this makes total sense. This is like, then you could see why this might be have been the origin of this old wives' tale. If you put hot water in the ice cube trays, the water will evaporate. You end up with smaller ice cubes. If you put cold water in, the entire cube may take longer to freeze down to the middle, but you end up with larger ice cubes.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't make more ice faster by putting in hot water. You actually end up with less ice, which dramatically reduces the volume to surface area and makes it freeze much quicker.
Well, obviously, there's less water, okay.
Yeah, there's less water.
That makes sense.
That's the reason. So the thermodynamics have not been violated in our freezers, but you have to account for evaporation.
Okay.
Well, that's a great website. Again, if you get a email from your friend saying, oh, did you ever hear about this, kid who needs money for an operation or, all of these things, these chain letters. If you look on that site, and there are some other sites that are similar, but this is an excellent one. It'll take you about 5 minutes to figure out that email is probably bogus, and with not just speculation, but often with real links to reliable information. So before you pass on that chain letter or that seemingly amazing fact or story that you received in email, use the internet for a little bit of research. Often that's what I do, and then I just reply and say, well, here's a link to Snopes.com, which, exposes this story to be bogus. And speaking of
emails,
scam emails, the bogus emails are used to spread a lot more than just benign urban legends. They're often used by dedicated con artists. Now, there have always been con artists, but they have found a very fertile ground in the internet and on email. And it's, unfortunately responsible for a great deal of spam. They don't have to have a very, high percentage of hit rates. You could send out, spam emails basically for free to thousands and thousands of people. And you only have to hit one gullible person in thousands, to make it pay off. In fact, in Connecticut, the Attorney General just recently sent out a warning about a specific new scam. This is Attorney General Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut, warned of a job offer, a bogus job offer, which is...
That's different.
That's a new angle. They always find new angles. Mm-hmm. This one, the job is an escrow agent. Escrow is when money's put aside to pay taxes or whatever. And what the job entails is that money will be placed into your private bank account in escrow, and then you pass the money on to some other company or whatever, and you keep a percentage of it for yourself, and that's your fee.
So
it sounds like an easy way to sort of make money on the side to supplement your income. But of course, they just all they're looking for is your bank account number,
mm-hmm.
and then once they get that, they'll drain it of whatever's in there. Plus, they also get other personal information. Then you could be in for complete.
You could suffer the horrors of identity theft.
Total identity theft, where that could take years to work your way out of that nightmare.
Oh yeah.
I can't imagine. I mean, after so much media and so much news attention to these scams, people are giving personal information to strangers. That's ultimately what it is.
Right.
I mean, I might be on the other end of the spectrum. I might be a little more paranoid than I need be. I mean, I'm getting these pop-ups on my Dell computer that seem pretty legitimate to me, but they're asking me, you know, go to this website and do this, and I'm skeptical even of those things.
Yeah,
that are probably okay, but I don't like anything popping up telling me to do something, even if it's apparently from my McAfee security system that's asking me to do it. And everything looks legitimate, and it's not a normal pop-up. It looks like a Dell type of pop-up. I still don't want to do it because I don't want to be prompted by anything to go on the internet and give away information about myself.
I agree with you. I don't think you're being too paranoid at all. I think that you basically, if you want to be safe, you shouldn't click on any links. You should type in the name of the address. If somebody sends you an unsolicited link, never click on it. There's one little key, though. You can put your mouse over the link,
right.
And
mm-hmm.
then in the lower left-hand corner of your web browser, it will show the name of the website that you're going to go to. And if that name doesn't match the name of the link that you're clicking on, that's a red flag that you're probably going to be missing.
It's not foolproof, but it's a red flag.
You're right. It's not foolproof. It's a red flag.
It's pretty good. But also, don't forget, Steve, they don't just say go to this HTTP /, and then give you the URL. Usually they say go to this link, and the words go to this link are hyperlinked, and you go over that. Now what you do is just today I got an email apparently from eBay saying that there's been some unusual activity in my account. Please go to this link and fix it.
That's, by the way, always a scam.
That's always a scam.
I highlighted a scam.
Well, here's a few ways you could tell. I mean, I highlighted the hyperlink, and the link, the domain, had nothing to do with eBay. And also,
or it goes to just numbers. You just get the number URL.
Right. You just get the IP or something. But also, it says, "Dear eBay member." I mean, they would never do that. They would say, "Dear," and then your
Robert
name.
Robert Novella, right.
Right. They would
dear,
they would
name
use
here.
Your name. And those are the two biggest. I mean.
And they also, nowadays, they make websites look like legitimate websites.
It could look exactly. They could exactly duplicate a legitimate site.
Exactly. And that's another, it's horrible. And also, it's not just scams and identity theft. It's also a way that they send out digital disease. So that's how viruses are spread. That's another horror.
I read about one that scared me. They can put, it's kind of like a Trojan horse where you get a virus. And what the virus sits in your system, and the next time you type in the URL to go to certain popular websites like eBay, it redirects you to a fake eBay site.
Wow!
So imagine that. So you're not clicking a link. You're not responding to anything. You're just, I'm going to go to eBay. You click on it. You type in the eBay address, and this virus redirects you to a fake site, and then it starts recording your keystrokes and taking your codes. Very insidious. That's why you have to have virus software running. You have to
absolutely
don't visit dubious websites or websites that don't seem legitimate, and you probably got the virus in the first place because you clicked the link you shouldn't have clicked.
Right. But Steve, the URL itself is subtly erroneous, right? I mean, it might be eBay's with an S.
No, Bob, you're typing in the real URL that you know of.
Right. But what are they redirecting you to?
It's hijacking your browser.
Right.
It's hijacking your
computer.
And
it takes you to a fake page that looks like eBay.
Right.
And the URL is correct. It looks correct.
It looks
anyway.
Correct, yes. Right.
Wow.
But it's all behind the scenes in the programming. It's getting redirected. It's nothing that you can see.
That's clever.
Yeah, very clever. I mean, this threatens internet commerce. If you can't be sure, if you can't be trusted that your credit card number is going to be secure, And, you know, and there have been examples of companies getting hijacked and,
sure,
and hacked, and there, you know, thousands and thousands of credit card numbers that get stolen. But, you know, this could really hamper commerce, cost the economy billions and billions of dollars. But you ask, Bob, who in this day and age would be dumb enough to give away personal information? And really, it does highlight the fact that the only defense against this is education, that people just have to realize, you know, what safe internet use is. That, and the bottom line is, no matter what the story, never, ever give away any personal information. No piece of your social security number. Here's one thing. A lot of people don't realize that the first part of your social security number, people can figure that out by when and where you were born.
That's right.
So
the state you were born in
and the year that you were born.
And year. Yep.
And if they can figure that out about you, which is, you know, probably information which is public knowledge, and you give them just the last few digits, last four digits of your social security number, they may be able to get the whole thing. So that seems innocuous.
Right.
But just the bottom line is, just doesn't matter what they say on the phone, what they say in email, whatever the offer is, just it's a scam. That's the bottom line. It's a scam. Don't click it. Don't go there. Don't buy it.
Your skeptical toolkit has got to be in order.
But unfortunately, the biggest victims of this are the elderly.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Now, it's, you know, our moms and dads, especially, you know, people who are, you know, because of just normal aging, or maybe they're starting to have some, you know, neurological problems, their judgment's not quite there. But they're still at the point where they're living independently. You know, maybe their children or their family knows that they're not as sharp as they used to be, or maybe they are sharp, but they're just not computer savvy. And, you know, how many of us have set our parents up with email and stuff so we can email them pictures of their grandkids? And then they're going to get these spam letters too, you know, these fake emails. So it's really the elderly who are either, you know, unfortunately, you know, having, you know, some early memory or judgment problems, or people who are really just not computer savvy. Those are the victims. And oftentimes the people who can least afford it. It's just dastardly. I mean, con artists like that really are very infuriating. You have to really just be evil to do that.
Insidious.
But speaking of cons, and this is two types of con in one. This is a con as in a convention, and a con as in totally bogus. In Stratford, Connecticut, at the Ramada Inn, was the 7th annual Paracon, or Paranormal Conference. Perry and I have been to these before. These are always entertaining.
Yeah.
It's just walk around listening to people's conversations.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at their feeble little displays. I mean, seriously, it's...
Not to stereotype, but these people are nuts. So the Paranormal Convention covered lots of different topics. Of course, UFOs. One guy was saying that this guy, Rossler, I guess he was one of the agents, and he was the agent in charge of the UFO Investigation Division of the Smoking Gun Research Agency, which held the convention. So the Smoking Gun Research Agency, their hope is to find smoking gun evidence of the paranormal, whether it's ghosts or aliens or Bigfoot or the Bermuda Triangle or whatever. So they're still hoping. So I guess he was in charge of the convention. He told the reporter that, "I've seen things I can't explain."
That's impossible. Right? Yeah.
So that's unexplainable.
They can't explain it.
This particular Ramada Inn at 225 Lordship Boulevard in Stratford, right off exit 30 on I-95, has become a haven.
How much did they pay for that ad?
Constant paranormal conventions at this particular Ramada Inn. It's just it's a place that these people have learned to love.
Why is that? Is it just culture?
They're there all the time. I don't know. I don't know. The right price? They're willing to host anybody?
Maybe one of the owners or the manager of the hotel, you know, has an affinity for that stuff.
It's possible. Yeah, it's possible. I guess they pay their bills. Certainly plenty of gullible people going to these conventions spending money.
Sure.
Well, these inns don't care. I mean, they rent out their rooms to whoever.
It's true.
As long as you're not doing anything illegal. I mean, they don't have any. And they shouldn't, really. I mean, it's really not up to them to decide what's legitimate and what's not legitimate. The only time that we actually tried to convince a hotel that they shouldn't host a conference was when Dennis Lee was making the rounds. Now, Dennis Lee is a con artist. I mean, this guy was out to rip people off. So he was doing something illegal. And in fact, the attorney generals of various states banned him from their states, basically declaring him, one attorney declared him a clear and present danger to the investing public.
Yeah, we were thrown out of the hotel.
Yeah. That's
we were
right.
thrown out. We were handing out flyers about what was going on, and one of his flunkies came along with the security guard and threw us off the property. That was it.
I remember that.
Security guard or the motel didn't give a damn.
Dennis Lee is a purveyor of basically free energy machines. You could put an adapter on
the price
car,
is right.
So you could run your car off of water or something, and keep trying to sell interest in his. Perpetual motion machines.
Well, he's almost got it perfected, but he just needs a little more capital to finish the job.
He's got a good scam because he's not selling the actual machines. He's just selling interest in the company, whatever, that's developing them. And, of course, it's just around. It's always right around the corner.
You're just moments away from making your millions. Yeah.
A lot of people working against him, Steve. A lot of giant corporation. If he were to come to the fore with his marvelous machines, they'd be out of business.
One of the attendees of the conference was John Zaffis Jr. Any of you know who this gentleman is?
Warren's.
Yep,
nephew.
He's a nephew of Ed and Lorraine Warren. We did a very, very long investigation of the claims of Ed and Lorraine Warren since they're in our neck of the woods, and apparently. Their tradition will be carried on by their nephew, John Zaffis. So he is a ghost buster, a ghost hunter. He claims that Stratford is a hotbed of hauntings. Of course it is.
A hotbed, I tell you.
He warns that people often mistake ghosts for demons.
Often.
Mm-hmm.
He also claims that they often mistake ghosts for gray aliens. So
Amazing.
You have a conflict between the ufologists and the Ghostbusters where...
What could the connection be?
What could it be?
Must be something. Do you think the aliens have an agreement with the ghost?
He tells a story of a quote-unquote young lady who awakened to find herself surrounded by grays.
I hate when that happens.
Zaffis said he didn't see anything himself, but determined she had actually encountered demons, not grays.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, a scientist might suggest that she was having a waking dream.
What? Para what now? What is that? According to Ed Warren, he told them about the...
hypnagogic hallucinations.
Yeah, hypnagogic hallucinations and pareidolia. What now? Hypno who? Guy's been studying ghosts for 50 years, didn't understand the most basic tenets of the human mind.
That's because science is boring.
Physiology.
So people often wake in the middle of the night, or either as they're going to sleep or as they're waking up, and they have what's called a waking dream. It's kind of a fusion of the sleep and wake states. So they'll hallucinate. They often might be terrified. Some people report feeling pressure on their chest.
Being paralyzed.
Yeah. Often feel specifically that there's a malevolent presence in the room with them. And, of course, if you've been reading the Warrens or Zaffis's, books and you believe in ghosts, you will interpret this experience as a ghost or demon, perhaps sucking away your life energy and hence the paralysis. And if you're a UFO buff, you will see gray aliens, little gray people, and perhaps you're paralyzed because they paralyzed you. And sometimes this evolves into an abduction scenario where they float you through walls and take you aboard the ship. And somehow or other, anal probes are always involved.
Right.
Still not exactly sure why.
Really, it's when you get right down to it, it's why I joined the skeptical movement to make myself immune to anal probes.
To anal probes.
That really was. That was the driving force behind my becoming a skeptic. I knew that skeptics were never abducted or possessed or haunted or trodden on by large feet, or so. I
But you know, otherwise you might wonder why would there be anything, why would, you know, UFOs and aliens have anything to do with ghosts and demons and hauntings, that they would share the same conference and that there would be so much crossover in believers, when really the one has nothing to do with the other in terms of underlying claims or principles. But I, you know, of course, as skeptics, we think they're all related because the underlying psychological and neurological phenomenon are all the same.
And level of credulity.
Guys, if you want to induce a waking dream tonight, I've done this and it's pretty cool. As you're dozing off, you know, not the moment you hit the bed, but after 5 or 10 minutes, you really feel like you're dozing off. Just think of your name. Just keep thinking of your name, and a lot of times when you do that, you will actually hear your name being spoken, just as if somebody was, you know, 2 feet away from you saying your name. But of course, hopefully, don't be scared now, but hopefully you'll realize that your mind is creating this little tiny mini waking dream as you're going to sleep, because that's one of the times it happens, you know, as you're dozing off or right after you wake up, and you can induce a little auditory waking dream on your own. Every time I've tried it, it works almost every time. It's pretty interesting.
Have any of you had a full-fledged waking dream?
I have never.
Three-dimensional and in color and all that stuff. I've had little mini versions of them, but I from talking to you, I know you've had some good ones.
I have had them many times, all induced by extreme sleep deprivation. I had them quite frequently when I was going through medical school, and I would have to stay up for, you know, 24, 36 hours at a stretch. They almost always happened when I went to bed early in the morning, you know, after being up for 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very, you know, unpleasant experience.
Is that fun?
It's not. It really isn't. You feel sort of trapped. You're sort of stuck between, you're not really sure if you're awake or not. I mean, that's the one thing. It's kind of like trying to wake up from a nightmare, and you think you have, but you really haven't. You really are still in the nightmare. Often associated with really unnatural terror, just a terror that you wouldn't really experience in your everyday waking life, just sort of a pure primal neurological terror. And you're paralyzed. So imagine being scared and paralyzed. I mean, that's the worst thing about it. You can't move. You can't even turn your head. You can't really make any noise. And I could certainly see that why people would find that to be a profound experience. And if they, you know, didn't know how to explain it medically, neurologically, would hypothesize all sorts of unusual, even paranormal things. It certainly is not an everyday experience.
It is an every night experience, except that you're actually asleep. People don't realize that your body actually paralyzes itself when you're sleeping. Otherwise, you would act out your dream. So it's a kind of a little safety precaution, so that you're not walking out windows and stuff. And
paralysis is normal during REM sleep, when you are dreaming. It's not normal though when you're in this sort of pseudo awake state, and that's what is unusual. Because when you're truly dreaming, you don't know that your body is paralyzed, because you have freedom of movement in your dream.
In the dream.
But in the waking state, with sleep paralysis, so-called sleep paralysis, you feel that you are paralyzed, and that in and of itself is scary.
So this John Zaffis Jr., the nephew of Ed and Lorraine Warren, he's sort of picking up their banner and carrying it forward.
That apparently.
Now that they're sort of past their prime. I guess the main question then is, will he also leave in his wake the strewn bodies of disgruntled, disillusioned ex-associates like Ed and Lorraine did?
It's hard to say.
It's hard to say.
Probably not. I don't think that. I mean, Ed and Lorraine Warren were a phenomenon. I don't know that.
That it'll be repeated.
It'll be repeated, because now there's just so many other groups. You know, at the time they were it, and that you just can't repeat that.
But their body count is extremely high, Steve.
Yes. We've personally met dozens of people who one time or another traveled with the Warrens, and now we're disenchanted with them and ghost-busting on their own, though. I mean,
all of them.
Warren turned off from ghost-busting just from the Warrens.
It's true. They're all disillusioned, not disillusioned enough, however, to become skeptics.
No, unfortunately.
Not that I recall, no.
Here's a comment from Zaffis. He says, in case you were wondering, demons aren't really as entertaining as in The Exorcist. There's no head spinning around or green pea soup ejections. He actually gets involved in exorcisms, not just investigating demons.
Good, good, good.
Which is, you know, I've seen hours and hours of tape of, you know, sort of...
And he's right, they are boring as hell.
Amateur exorcisms, they are boring. Basically, nothing happens.
Yeah, nothing. They're terrible.
Probably, and this is just a guess, probably because there aren't really demons. Demons are not real.
Wait a minute now.
No, I hate to invoke Occam's razor, but that is perhaps a simple explanation. One incredible observation that was made by, you know, a true believer, after going through the motions of an exorcism on these poor little kids who were just normal kids with a nutty mother. Mm-hmm. Literally nothing happened. They just sat there. They were, you know, the worst that you could say about them is that these, you know, 4, 6, 7-year-old kids who were basically made to sit in a chair for an hour were fidgety, you know, which is, my daughter would have been behaved worse than these kids did. And the comment was, well, that's the way it's supposed to go. I mean, the demons, as soon as you walk in the room, referring to the defrocked priest who was doing the exorcism, then you just scared them out the door, so they just fled without a fight. Okay, so if something happens, that's proof, and if nothing happens, well, that's proof too.
That's a win-win.
It's a win-win.
That's right.
Or confirmation bias, you know, whatever. Tomato, tomato.
Whatever it takes.
That's a good example of just, if you start with the conclusion, and you're basically will fit all whatever happens, you'll fit it into the preconceived conclusion that you have. There's no possibility of falsification. No matter what happens or doesn't happen, it's all consistent with a real demon possession and exorcism.
Right.
So it becomes unscientific because it's unfalsifiable.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that is all the time that we have for this week. Perry, Bob, Evan, thanks for joining me again.
Thank you, Steve.
My pleasure.
And thank you, everyone out there, for listening. Until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is a production of the New England Skeptical Society. For more information on this and other episodes, see our website at www.thenes.com.